Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom. Greetings from Orange County in Florida. Beautiful Orlando. They call this place, the nickname of this place is the City Beautiful. But we were in a very beautiful place last week, as a lot of you know. We were out in California, and we certainly appreciate all those who came out to that occasion. We had a pretty full house in the morning and then pretty good turnout in the afternoon. And we appreciate everybody who showed interest, and we know that there were certain ones who wanted to come in at the last minute. Certain complications prevented it, so thank you for your interest. And I know that many of you, or at least some of you, will be listening to this either live or many of you listen later on. We'll be listening perhaps this evening or later on in the week. We just had the holiday of Purim, and on Purim, of course, we think about Mordecai, but we also think about Esther. The book is called the Book of Esther. She was one of the great women of the Bible. And as you know, in the Bible, the church is pictured as a woman. And in the Old Testament, of course, there was a marriage with God marrying Israel. And in the New Testament, we find Christ marrying the church. Today, I wanted to talk about some of the great women who are part of our heritage. And I call this talk, Rachel Shall Be Comforted. Rachel Shall Be Comforted. I want to begin by going to the second chapter of Matthew. Rachel, of course, came from north of Canaan. She was the daughter of Laban, Jacob's uncle. Laban, the brother of Rebekah. As you know, the church is built on the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the matriarchs, Sarah, Rebekah, Rachel, and Leah. Those are the seven major personalities that are the background of the church. First of the people of Israel, and then, of course, of the church in a spiritual sense. And along with them, of course, Rachel had a maiden, Bilhah, who had two children, and then Leah had a maid, Zilpah, who had two children. So in that sense, there were nine individuals who were the progenitors of the nation of Israel, which becomes the prototype for the church. But although Rachel came from north of the promised land, eventually she accompanied her husband, and as he returned to the land, he was in exile up there in Syria with his uncle Laban. And he had his ups and downs over there, as one does when one is in exile. But then he returned to the land, returned to the south, to the land of Canaan, and there Rachel died, giving birth to the 12th son of Jacob. And she died around the area of Bethlehem. And so that area came to be associated with her. Another name for that area was Ephrata, because it was a fruitful place. It was a place where there was a lot of fertile land, where wheat was grown. Bethlehem means house of bread. It was a granary. And, of course, Bethlehem is where Christ was born. He is the bread of life, as you know, John 6:48. And Bethlehem was the city of David, of course, and so it was the city of Christ. But it also was a city associated with Rachel, who died there. So that area has an association with Rachel, as I said. And I want to go to Matthew 2, and here we find that Christ was born, and Herod, a tyrant, a maniacal tyrant, felt threatened by this coming Messiah and wanted to destroy him. I want to go to verse 13. The wise men visited the Christ child, not immediately at his birth, but sometime after. And then they were warned, and so they went away, a different route, though, than the route that they had followed coming there. And then in verse 13 of Matthew 2, now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young Christ to destroy him. So all of these events, of course, are orchestrated because various prophecies are being fulfilled. Christ's life took various paths because of prophecies. And this was a prophecy that had been applied to Israel, but also was going to be applied to Christ, because he was the representative of all of Israel. He was the coming king of Israel and their representative. So even though the prophecy was about Israel, it also was about him. When he arose, this is talking about Joseph, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I called my son. And if you go back to that chapter, you'll see it. Superficially, you'd apply it to Israel, but now you see that it applies to the Christ child, the Son of God. Verse 16, then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry, and he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its districts, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men. He wanted to make sure he was going to get rid of that king, that coming king, so he killed all of the children in that region. And this is so typical, you know, of the mind of Satan. You know, Purim, which we just celebrated, Tuesday and Wednesday, were commemorations of a time when Haman was inspired to want to destroy all Jews in the Persian Empire, which would have meant virtually almost all Jews in the world. And they were spared miraculously. And then we have the story of Moses, and Moses was a type of Christ, and Moses was born under circumstances where all of the male children were being killed, and he was miraculously spared. And Christ here is miraculously spared because an angel appears, you know, to Joseph and warns him so they can leave. So it's a similar pattern through history. Sometimes Satan tries to thwart God's plan by deceiving people. Sometimes he does it simply by trying to wipe out God's people. Verse 17, then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, a voice was heard in Ramah. Now, by the way, even Jeremiah has a relationship to Rachel. I'm talking today about Rachel, who died near Bethlehem. And Rachel was the mother of Benjamin. And Jeremiah lived in a town which was in the territory of Benjamin. He was a priest, but he lived in the territory of Benjamin. So he had a relationship with Rachel, living in Benjamite territory. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet, saying, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning. Ramah would be in that same area. Lamentation, weeping, and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. So here's a prophecy where Jeremiah says that in a poetic sense, I mean, obviously Rachel is dead. She's not conscious. She's, you know, God will resurrect her, I believe. But she's dead. She doesn't know anything or feel anything right now, doesn't remember anything, isn't functioning right now. But poetically speaking, you know, she's mourning because that's the area where she died. And so that's her area in a sense. And she's mourning for these other children, these innocent children who have died. Lamentation, weeping, and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. And that's the prophecy. And it was a prophecy of this time when Herod was going to wipe out all of these children trying to destroy the Christ child. But this prophecy, just as the first one, applied also to Israel. Remember the first prophecy we got about out of Egypt I've called my son, referred to Christ, but also referred to Israel. This prophecy also refers to Israel. Now let me comment that because I believe in what the Bible teaches, because I believe in a resurrection, I believe these children will be resurrected. I believe these children will have an opportunity to be part of God's family forever. So I believe that Rachel shall be comforted, that these children that she's mourning here in the poetic sense, she will someday greet. In a literal sense, they will be alive and they will have that opportunity to be a part of God's family. But she's going to be also comforted in another way. And to understand that, we have to go back to the original prophecy in Jeremiah. So let's go to Jeremiah 31, to that original prophecy. And this chapter is the prophecy. In this very chapter is the prophecy of the new covenant. There are a lot of powerful verses in the chapter I'm reading. In other words, this section of Jeremiah, because of course the Bible wasn't originally in chapters, but in this section you could say of Jeremiah is some very powerful material. And I'm going to begin reading in Jeremiah 31 in verse 15. Thus says the Eternal, a voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation and bitter weeping, Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted, for her children because they are no more. Well, you just heard that verse written, read. But there was another application of the prophecy. When Jeremiah uttered it here, he was applying it to Israel. He was applying it to the Israelites, of course, Benjamin included, who were exiled, descendants of Rachel, and of course also of the other mothers, you know, exiled in captivity. And he said that eventually they would return from captivity. So Jeremiah is looking far out into the future. There was a partial restoration, of course, after the Babylonian captivity. But even then, many Israelites lived in exile. But then there's going to be an even greater restoration of all the tribes of Israel, ultimately. So there will be comfort for Rachel. Thus says the Eternal in verse 16, refrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears. For your work shall be rewarded, says the Eternal, and they shall come back from the land of the enemy. So this is talking about the regathering of Israel. There is hope in your future. Now this theme, of course, greatly inspired the Jews over history, and they always looked forward, of course, to returning to their land. And the Zionist movement adopted as its national anthem the song HaTikvah, the hope. That's now the national anthem of the state of Israel, HaTikvah, or as we call it in America, HaTikvah, the hope. And here it says, there is hope in your future, says the Eternal, that your children shall come back to their own border. So as part of the restoration that God is going to bring about, he's going to return and rule the world. Jesus Christ is coming to rule the world, and part of what he does is to restore Israel, bring them back to their own land. Now, I'm not talking politically. I'm not talking right now about international politics. When you try to mix theology with politics, you make a big mistake. Ethics, yes. There are basic ethics that, you know, politicians should practice and often don't. I do believe in being ethical, you know, when you deal with world events. But you don't mix necessarily theology in world events, or you really get into trouble. But I'm talking here about God's plan of salvation. Whatever we may do in the meantime, whatever human beings do in the meantime, there is an ultimate plan. And it involves the second coming of Christ and the restoration of Israel to its land. You know, that's part of the plan of salvation, and that's what we're reading about here. So indeed, Rachel shall be comforted. Rachel shall be comforted in two ways. You know, by the resurrection, bringing back those children who were martyred, and also by the restoration of her people. You know, both of those events are part of this prophecy, and they will be a comfort to Rachel. But in the meantime, you know, great women of the Bible inspire us now as part of God's church. And I want to cover some of those examples today. And one of them, of course, is Rachel herself. I want to talk a little bit about Rachel herself. Rachel means a female sheep, a ewe, E-W-U. And she was a very delightful woman. Evidently very beautiful, and Jacob loved her very dearly. And in Genesis 31, when Jacob first saw her, this is Genesis 31, of course, he was in exile now. He was wandering away from home, must have been very lonely and also very vulnerable. You know, he was afraid his brother might want to kill him, and so his mother said to leave and so on. I'm sorry, where was I? I want to go back to Genesis 29. I'm sorry. Genesis 29. And here he meets some people at a well, verse 9. And while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. So as far as what her occupation was, she was a shepherdess. And it came to pass, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. And evidently, this was not an easy thing to do, and he evidently was a person of great physical strength. It's not something I've thought about until today, reading some accounts, and I noticed that a commentary had pointed out how strong he was. I hadn't really thought of it, but you remember he was in a wrestling match where he did pretty well for himself, well, even though he got injured. But I mean, if you're wrestling against God, you're not going to win. But he did pretty well for himself. So evidently he was a pretty strong fellow. But anyway, he now he sees a relative. You know, he sees the family that he's looking for. You know, then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. You know, this is his relative. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. So she ran and told her father. And so you know that he stays with Laban. And in verse 16, now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes, or Leah as we say in English, Leah's eyes were delicate. So maybe that's a good thing, you know. Maybe she had pretty eyes, but evidently she wasn't that, you know, she wasn't a bombshell. When she first, you know, walked on the scene, you wouldn't necessarily be struck by her except perhaps her eyes. On the other hand, Rachel was the kind that you'd be, you know, you'd want to have as a model, perhaps a Hollywood model. You know, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. So between the two of them, you know, Rachel would have been, you know, had the higher grade in just in terms of looks. Now Jacob loved Rachel. So you know the story. I'm going to try to save time by just saving time on the details here, because we all know the story. He told Laban he'd work 7 years for Rachel. Then when the time came, Laban substituted Leah. And so we'll get to that point. Verse 26. And Laban said, "It must not be done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn." Well, this is a fine time to tell him, you know. But anyway, now I get the idea. Now I could be wrong. I get the idea that he was drunk. He'd had a wonderful time, you know, at the wedding reception, had too much to drink, and didn't even realize that he was having intercourse with the wrong sister, you know. That would seem, if you have some other theory, you can pass it on to me. But anyway, the next morning he looks and he sees it's not the right woman. And so he's upset about it, but Laban says, "That's all right, I'll give you the other woman if you have to give me 7 more years. Well, that was the kind of conniver Laban was. But see, Jacob had been a conniver when he was young. So, if you know, what goes around comes around. He was getting back what he'd given, in effect. Because he was, excuse me, he was a bit of a conniver himself. You know, now later on, of course, he comes to the point where you could call conversion. And I do believe that, you know, Jacob ultimately, you know, had a converted mind. But I'm not sure he did at this point. He was a devout person, but not necessarily a converted mind. Anyway, Laban takes advantage of him, but he has a honeymoon week with Leah, then he marries Rachel. Fulfill her week, this is verse 27, and we will give you this one also, for the service which you will serve me still another 7 years. He was ultimately 40 years up there in exile. He had time to have 12 sons and a daughter. Well, actually, the 12th son he had when he left. But he had 11 sons and a daughter, and Rachel was pregnant with the 12th son when they fled. Evidently. Then Jacob did so and fulfilled her. Well, I'm not absolutely sure of that, but I would say she certainly had the son pretty soon when they got back. Then Jacob did so and fulfilled her week. So he gave him his daughter Rachel as wife also. Now, this is not something, by the way, that God allowed in later years. I'm going to turn to Leviticus 18. Verse 18, all right? Leviticus 18, verse 18. Now, there are a lot of things you're not supposed to do in terms of sex that have to do with what we call incest. You know, getting involved sexually with people who are close relatives. You know, there are a lot of prohibitions on that in Leviticus 18. And, of course, the federal government today, in some ways, is even stricter for health reasons. Evidently, as history has progressed, it's gotten more dangerous for closer relatives to be involved with each other in that way. In the time of the Bible, first cousins could marry, but that's against the law here. Now, as far as I understand, in Saudi Arabia, it's legal. So there maybe are still some cultures where first cousins marry, but it certainly isn't done here. In biblical times, though, it was done. But it seems that as history has progressed, I don't know the biology behind it, but as history progresses, it's more and more dangerous for closer relatives to be involved sexually. But there are certainly a lot of prohibitions here in Leviticus 18 that are valid, that ought to be observed, and most societies do observe them, at least on paper. In Leviticus 18:18, it says, "Nor shall you take a woman as a rival to her sister, to uncover her nakedness while the other is alive." So even in a society where polygamy was tolerated, it was regulated so that you didn't marry two sisters. That was not allowed. Even in a polygamous society, you didn't do that because you don't want to, you know, engender a rivalry between sisters in that way. You know, you don't want to undermine a family in that way. And you see, there was a rivalry with Rachel and Leah, which was unfortunate because they were sisters. And there were times when they cooperated, but there, you see, there was a rivalry between them, which is sad. And that is the way it is in a harem. And a harem is not intrinsically a good thing. Obviously, God's way is monogamy, and you see that harems are not the way to go. I had the experience of talking to a lady from Saudi Arabia when I was teaching English in California, and she told me a little bit about polygamy. She was not in a polygamous relationship herself, but she, of course, had a lot of experience with polygamy coming from Saudi Arabia, and she told me that her from what she knows, what she knew about it, there's a lot of strife among the women in a polygamous marriage. There is a rivalry between the wives, and, you know, one can understand that. So I wouldn't recommend it. Anyway, to go on with Genesis here, Rachel was married to him, as was Leah, and also their maids came along, not as necessarily partners at first, but they came along to help. Later on, they became partners, the reason being, in those days, when a woman was childless, what she would do is take her slave, her female slave, and have the husband have a child by the slave, and that child became the adopted child of the mother. So it was a way of having children in some sense. And even though we look at that practice now in a negative way, I don't think most women would want their husband now, if, let's say, they couldn't give him a child, that they would say, well, how about, you know, have a child by my maid? And, you know, that's not what a woman would suggest nowadays in our culture. I doubt it. But in that culture, it was the norm to do. If you couldn't have a child by the wife would volunteer her maid, and then that child became the mistress's child. That, in that indirect sense, the mistress had given you the child. So even though culturally it's to us maybe bizarre, it was the norm in that society. So both Leah and Rachel gave their handmaids to Jacob, and there were two children of each of them, and they became part of the tribes of Israel as well. That's just the way the culture goes. Now, when you look back on these events in the Bible, you sometimes wonder how did all this happen? Well, I think one reason it all happened this way is because not everybody, you know, of these Bible heroes are necessarily, you know, they're not perfect people. They've got their flaws. And in fact, it takes time till they develop, until they really come to, as I said, having the converted minds that they're supposed to have. And even when they have them, at times they slip. The point is that history is a messy thing. You know, the way we've gotten from point A to point B is not the ideal way. History is very messy, unfortunately, and this is the reality that we have to deal with. So the Bible has in effect the characters of the Bible, warts and all, you know, for us to observe. But still, we want to think about the good example that we see when we study these people in the Bible. And, for example, in the case of these women, we understand they had great respect for their husband. They wanted also to produce children. Perhaps they had a sense of the importance of the family line and of the importance of what they were doing in terms of establishing a nation. They were, in effect, beginning a nation that would be God's nation. God had made promises to Abraham, promises to Isaac, promises to Jacob. So they were building, you know, a nation for God. Anyway, to go back then to the actual text here, verse 30. Then Jacob also went to Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban still another 7 years. When the Eternal saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So, you know, Leah had the advantage, you know, that she had more children than Rachel. She has one after another, and finally, when all is said and done, she has four sons, and then two others by her handmaiden, and then finally a daughter, Dinah, if you want to use the American pronunciation, and then two other sons are born by the she has six sons, and then two by the handmaiden, eight altogether. And then two are born to Bilhah's, to Rachel's handmaiden. And then finally, you know, the 11th son is born to Rachel herself. And we come to that in Genesis 30 and verse 22. Genesis 30, 22. Then God remembered Rachel, and God listened to her and opened her womb. So finally, you know, she had a child. And she conceived and bore a son and said, God has taken away my reproach. So she called his name Joseph. You know, and Joseph, in a sense, means increase. And there was a time, you know, there was a great character in colonial America whose name was Increase Mather. He was a leader in the Puritan community. Increase Mather, perhaps, is how you pronounce his name. But it's interesting that that didn't catch on as a name. Instead of translating Joseph and naming your sons Increase, most Americans just call their kids, their sons Joseph. And, you know, so I've met plenty of people named Joe, but I've never met anybody named Increase. Just didn't catch on to translate the name. All right, so she named him Joseph, meaning may he add, you know, and said, the Eternal shall add to me another son. And in fact, that's what happened. There was another son that God gave her. And so Rachel is the mother of Joseph and Benjamin. And those tribes are very prominent in the history of Israel. Joseph, the firstborn of Rachel, became the birthright tribe, the tribe given the greatest physical blessings. And he had two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh was the firstborn, but Ephraim became dominant. And so those two tribes became the birthright tribes. They became nations. And the most prosperous nations in human history have been the descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh. But Benjamin also has been very important in the history of the Bible. Benjamin was given the territory in which the temple stood. Although Jerusalem was basically in the territory of Judah, the piece of territory on Mount Moriah where the temple stood was in the territory of Benjamin. And the Apostle Paul was of the tribe of Benjamin. So Benjamin, you know, has an important role to play. Anyway, Jacob flees from Laban, finally, and comes back. God intervened, told him, get out, and he did. Laban pursued him, but God intervened with Laban and said, leave him alone. So Laban did. But notice that when he fled, Rachel made a mistake, but she was doing this perhaps with good motivation. I'm going to now to Genesis 31. Verse 19, okay? Now Laban had gone to share his sheep, but Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. Now she stole these idols that were her father's. They're called in Hebrew teraphim. Now what is the significance of these teraphim? Archaeologists and scholars will say that in ancient times these idols were kept as a symbol of who was the patriarch in the family and who would inherit the family property. So this was a legal sign of inheritance. And so she took, now it may be just one idol or maybe several. The text is unclear on this. She took this statue or the small statue or several small statues because she felt perhaps that her husband, Jacob, was really entitled to inherit from her brother, from her father after all that had happened. Her father had treated him so badly, tried to cheat him over and over again, and she felt that ultimately he should be the one who inherits, you know, from her father, so she stole these idols. But still, it was the wrong thing to do, and I don't know if that's why she died prematurely, but she did die in childbirth after stealing these idols. Now, if you'll notice, Laban was very upset that the idols were stolen in verse 30. But now, Laban says, you have surely gone because you greatly long for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods? Or my God singular? As I said, it's ambiguous. Then Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. Don't give me all this talk about, oh, how could you leave? You know, I like that. I left because of the way you've been treating me, you know. With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So he, in effect, says, whoever did this ought to be executed. You know, that's what happened, unfortunately, to Rachel, whom he loved. But he didn't know that Rachel had done it. And it's interesting that they were not able to search her. She got away with it. In verse 34, now Rachel had taken the household idols, put them in the camel's saddle, and sat on them. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me. And he searched, but did not find the household idols. So he never would have dreamed, I guess, that Rachel would have done such a thing, but she did. And it is, as I said, a thing she should not have done, but you could perhaps see her motive was sticking up for her husband who'd been so oppressed by her father. And Jacob, on the other hand, perhaps spoke too rashly when he said, let whoever did it be put to death, because, you know, let's back off. Why was it done and so forth? What's the background? The punishment for thievery is not capital punishment, you know, necessarily. So, you know, he may have spoken somewhat rashly there. Anyway, if we continue on, I'm going to go now to Genesis 35. And to skip time, to save time, I'll just go to the point where Rachel is having her final child on the way to Bethlehem. Let's go to verse 16. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and this is Genesis 35:16. And when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel labored in childbirth, and she had hard labor. Now it came to pass when she was in hard labor that the midwife said to her, "Do not fear, you will have this son also." And so it was, you know, as her soul was departing, in other words, her very life was leaving her. There's no real good word in English for this, I guess, her vitality, her animation, her life-ness. There's no such word in English, I guess, as life-ness. Her being, let's say her being. As her being was departing her, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, right? Son of my affliction, or son of my sorrow. She called him Ben-Oni because she had such a terrible time, and she was dying, giving him life. But his father called him Binyamin, or Benjamin, son of my right hand, which also means son of the south, because he was born south of Syria. He was born, unlike all the other children, he was born in the promised land. So he was the son of the south, but also the son of my right hand. Why was he the son of the right hand? Because in the Middle East, or in ancient Israel anyway, you talked about direction, you faced east. And so on your right was the south. Follow that? Now look at the Middle East today. Go to Jerusalem and look east, and then go south. And what country do you come up with in the Arabian Peninsula on the south? Yemen. Yemen is in the south, right? And as I said, Yamin is on the right, and Yamin is also the south, because if you look east, south is on your right. So anyway, he called him son of the right hand. But I think it was also a prophecy, a desire that Benjamin be a strong and mighty son, and he was the last son of Jacob, and so he would, in effect, renew the youth of Jacob. Verse 19. So Rachel died and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar in her on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. Now there still is a place in the land of Israel today called Kever Rachel, the tomb of Rachel. But scholars argue it's not actually valid. But there is a place there. But scholars, you know, contest it. But at least at that time, which is thousands of years ago, there was a pillar there that people could see, you know, at the time this was written. So that's a little bit about Rachel, who was one of the founding mothers of the family of Israel, very beloved of Jacob, who gave him two very special sons, Joseph and Benjamin. And she was one of the mothers of the nation, and she was associated with Bethlehem, which was the city of David, the city of the kings of Israel. And even though Bethlehem was in the territory of Judah, but Rachel had died there, so she's associated with it. In fact, I remember one year when the Ambassador College students were involved in a dig, an excavation in Jerusalem, and they stayed at a kibbutz, a collective settlement near Bethlehem. It was called Mitzpeh Rachel, Rachel's Watchtower. I'd like to go to the book of Ruth. You see the importance of the family and the importance of the family of Israel and how people viewed the fact that indeed a nation was being built. As I study the Bible more and more over my life, I see more and more the importance of family in the Bible. In the book of Ruth, when Ruth married Boaz, they blessed the marriage, the people, the area. And this is Bethlehem, remember, where the marriage is taking place. Verse 11. And all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. The Eternal make this woman who is coming to your house, like Rachel and Leah, excuse me, the two who built the house of Israel." Pardon me. "And may you prosper in Ephrata and be famous in Bethlehem. See, this is a parallelism. This is the way, you know, Hebrew poetry is. Ephrata or Bethlehem is another way of saying the same thing. May you prosper in Ephrata and be famous in Bethlehem. So here they refer to Rachel and Leah as the mothers of the nation, especially, you know, keeping in mind that they are in Bethlehem, near where Rachel died. Now, as I said, Rachel shall be comforted. Rachel, poetically, saw her people exiled from that region where she died. She saw, in a poetic sense, the death of the martyred children at the time of Christ, the innocents who died, but she will be comforted. And her family continues to be so important in biblical history, so important in world history for that matter, even in the secular history of the world. The people of Rachel are very important. I want to go into the book of Numbers, and I want to talk about some daughters of Manasseh. Now, Manasseh was the firstborn of Joseph, who was the son of Rachel. And he had some very assertive women. Now, Alexis de Tocqueville came to the United States in the 1830s, and we're still talking about what he wrote. What he wrote was so outstanding that we're still talking about it in 2009. Now, just recently, I saw in a magazine, I don't want to tell you which one because it's very politically, partisan, or at least ideologically partisan, so I probably shouldn't tell you which magazine I read it in. But they actually had a whole statement by Alexis de Tocqueville in the magazine because it just seemed prophetic for the United States in 2009. People are very well aware of what he wrote, Alexis de Tocqueville. He wrote two books called Democracy in America. He visited here from France during the days of Andrew Jackson. Well, one thing he said about America was great because of the greatness of its women. Well, that goes back, frankly, to the women of Manasseh. I believe that Americans, you know, not everybody here, but that the native Sauk that came here and settled the country, colonized it, and developed the institutions of the country, I believe they were descendants of Manasseh. Now, you don't have to believe that, you know, to be, you know, in my opinion, you can be in God's church and not believe that. You can even be in the ministry and not believe that. But I do believe it. I do believe that America is Manasseh in prophecy. But anyway, look at Numbers 27. Then came the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, from the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, who was, of course, the son of Rachel. I'm adding, right? And these were the names of his daughters, Mahla, Noah, Hoglah, Milcah, and Tirzah. This is not the same Noah as the name of the man Noah. It's spelled differently. It's not pronounced the same in Hebrew. It looks similar in English, but it isn't the same. Then they stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest. And by the way, Tirzah later, was a city, a major city in the northern kingdom. And they stood before Moses, before Eleazar the priest, and before the leaders and all the congregation by the doorway of the tabernacle of meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness, but he was not in the company of those who gathered together against the Eternal, in company with Korah, but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons." So our father was not a rebel. He didn't die in rebellion. He simply died, like any normal person dies. But he wasn't guilty of any crime. So why should the name of our father be removed from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. Why can't we inherit? We're women, yes, but we have no brother. Why can't we inherit? So Moses brought their case before the Eternal, and the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "The daughters of Zelophehad speak what is right. You shall surely give them a possession of inheritance among their father's brothers and cause the inheritance of their father to pass to them." And so then you see a whole list of laws here about what happens if there is no male heir, you know, and I won't go through all of that. But what's important is that these women asked a question, a legitimate question. And they got an answer. You know, God said, "You've asked a good question, I'm going to give you the answer." The answer is, yes, go. You should inherit because, you'd have no brother, so you should inherit from your father. So because these daughters spoke up and asked a good question, they got the right answer. Daughters of Zelophehad, these were Manassite women, daughters of Rachel. Now, at the end of the Bible, at the end of the book of Numbers, rather, you'll see that there was one complication with this, and the complication had to do with the fact that the daughters of Zelophehad were going to inherit land, but that means they needed to marry within their own tribe, and so that was established as well. If you inherit property because you have no brother, so you inherit your father's property, then marry within your own tribe, so the land is not lost to the tribe. Now, you might say that that would limit them, but just to make note of something, if you go back to Numbers 26, you don't have to turn there, but there were at that time 52,700 Manassites living all together in the wilderness. 52,700 Manassites. I think this is just talking about the males, too, the adult males. So that's enough adult males to provide husbands for those five women. So I think they were okay. So anyway, they had to marry within their own tribe, which they did, and so therefore the land was not lost to the tribes. Everybody follow until now? So these are the daughters of Zelophehad, and they are mentioned several times in the Bible, their names, because they're important in history. Mala, Tirzah, Hogla, Milcah, and Noah. And they are daughters of Rachel. Now I want to go to the story of Esther. And I have to spend another 40 minutes on that. No, I won't, but I would like to, but I won't because I know you have other things to do. Some of you have to eat and other things, you know. But let's take a look at the book of Esther. Now, I'm not going to go over all of it. Hopefully you have read it this week, or you will, because this was the end of the week of Purim. And I know it's not a commanded festival on the church, but it is certainly a recommended thing to read the book during this time of the year. I don't want to make that a requirement either in that sense. I don't want you to think you have to do it. I'm just recommending it. The Jews, of course, celebrate Purim. But in Esther 2, we find that in Shushan, the citadel, in verse 5, the capital of the Persian Empire, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. Now, Mordecai was a Jew. That was his identity. But the Jews are made up of different tribes. And one of them is Benjamin, as Paul. Paul was a Benjamite. I would be considered a Jew, and I'm of the tribe of Aaron, of Levi, of the people of Aaron, the priest, a Kohen. So as I said, among the Jews there are differences there of tribe. And here we find that there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. And notice, if you keep on reading, that he adopted, I'll just read it, verse 7. And Mordecai brought up Hadassah, perhaps her name means myrtle, but that was her Hebrew name. She went by the name Esther. And Mordecai brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. Now, that makes her a cousin of his, and so he adopted her. For she had neither father nor mother, so she's an orphan girl, and she's adopted by her uncle. Now, her uncle is a Benjamite, but that doesn't mean necessarily that she was. For example, my father was a Kohen, a priest, but my mother was not. All right, so that means her brother was not. So that means my uncles on my mother's side are not priests, and that means their children are not priests. Follow what I'm saying? So the fact that he was a Benjamite doesn't mean that Esther was. She might have been and she might not have been. But he did adopt her. So at least she was adopted by a Benjamite, reared by a Benjamite. And in that sense, she has a connection with Benjamin and therefore a connection with Rachel. So she's at least an honorary daughter of Rachel in that sense, right? And the young woman was lovely and beautiful, as was Rachel, right? Lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. And you know the story. She became the queen of the Empire of Persia. Now, I won't read chapter 2, though I wanted to, for lack of time. But it was not an easy thing she went through. I mean, this story, unfortunately, a lot of people, when they're Jewish, hear it as children, and that's all they know about the story. They never take the trouble to really study it as adults. This is not a light... I mean, sure, Purim is a time when Jews really cut up. I mean, probably the tradition of Jewish comedians is partly because of Purim. On Purim, the Jews would just go all out and make fun of everything and so forth. And maybe that's part of the reason why Jewish comics are, the world is full of Jewish comics, I guess. It's a very serious thing she went through. If you read Esther 2, it's not an easy thing to become part of a harem. But why did she do this? It wasn't plan A. But God's people were in exile. That's why Rachel's crying. Rachel's weeping for her children because they're in exile. And when you're in exile, you're not in an ideal situation. But she went through all this on behalf of her people. Because imagine having a Jew as queen. That's really something. That's important. So she did it. And it turned out it was quite important, but you know, we don't want to minimize the sacrifice of becoming part of a harem, all she went through here. And it's found in chapter 2. You can go through it. And finally, in chapter 4, we find that her uncle, her cousin Mordecai, who had adopted her, for whom she had great respect, she honored him as a parent and respected him. Even after she became an adult and even after her marriage, she greatly respected her adoptive father. She set quite an example in that way. And in verse 14, Mordecai tells her, if you want to back down and not fulfill this responsibility, God will intervene. But don't think that you're going to get away. I mean, the Jews are going to be massacred, and don't think you're going to get away. God will intervene, but you won't be spared because of your attitude. Verse 14. Well, let me go back to verse 13. This is Esther 4, verse 13. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. If you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Maybe this is why you are placed in this position, to be there right at this time. And that's a principle that rabbis have taught, that God will give you the cure before the disease. Esther became queen before the extermination plot occurred. So God already had the solution before the problem. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai. Now I'm in verse 16 now of Esther 4. Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me, neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise, and I will go to the king, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. You see, being in a harem meant you had to only come when you were summoned, or you could be killed. That's the nature of autocracy, of tyranny. You want to be very careful, those of you who think that's a better form of government. I've heard people say, it would be nice to have a benign dictator. No, it wouldn't. For one thing, if you have a benign dictator, the whole country does not develop the character it should, because people are dependent on this all-powerful ruler, and it affects the whole culture and the whole way of thinking. So a benign dictator is not necessarily a good form of government, if it's a benign human dictator. By the way, how many benign dictators have there been anyhow? You know? Anyway, so Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. So the Jews fasted and prayed. And before the festival of Purim, there is even today a fast of Esther. And then first comes the fasting, and then comes the feasting and the joviality, if you want to use that term, you know, the celebrating of Purim. Anyway, to make a long story short, in Esther 5, she's very careful how she handles it, very tactful, very diplomatic. That's very important for people to study. Because if you're in a situation where you've got a boss or a superior, there's a right and a wrong way to handle your boss or your superior if you have a request to make. You know, you need to be tactful. And she was very careful how she handled the situation. Just beautiful the way she worked through the situation. And her wisdom is to be studied in terms of how she handled it. Another woman in earlier history to be studied in that same regard is Abigail when she came to David. You know, to study how they handled the situation where they had to deal with one, you know, in great authority. Anyway, we know what happened, or hopefully you do. You know, Esther went to the king. The king understood the Haman's plot, got very angry about the situation, and finally got rid of Haman, gave his position to Mordecai. And all of Haman's plots turned against him. Everything he wanted to do was in effect done to him and his family. You know, everything completely reversed itself. There was a complete reversal of fortune. And so the day is called Purim because Haman had cast lots, or Purim, you know, to decide when to massacre all the Jews. So the festival is called Purim because in effect, you know, the lot turned and the events turned around and everything that was supposed to happen to the Jews happened to their enemies instead. And all of that came through, of course, the efforts of Esther. So in chapter 8, we find that Esther still has to be careful because the matter isn't yet resolved. Okay, Haman is dead. His sons are dead. But what about this order that went out to kill all the Jews? You know, that still had to be dealt with. And so once again, Esther has to come to the king. The king has to give her permission to speak. We're in verse 4 now of Esther 8. And the king held out the golden scepter toward Esther. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, "If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the things seem right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes." See how careful she is? She has to be very careful. You know, sometimes you might think, you know, you're 100% right, but you still have to deal with the reality of the situation. You're where you are, your boss is where he is, and you have to deal with the situation according to the reality of it. And I'm faced with the reality of this timekeeper, you know, but anyway. If it pleases the king, and if I have found favor in his sight, and the thing seems right to the king, and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, the son of Hamadatha the Agagite, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in all the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? All right, so the king again responded positively, and he sent out letters to revoke Haman's decree. The Jews had access to Wins, I assume, and the Jews had access to the police forces of the king, the armies of the king, I presume, and so now they had the advantage. Now their enemies were the ones that had to worry, and they dealt with their enemies. Now, if you study the book of Esther, you'll find there's a lot of details here that have to do with the Persian Empire of that time. And it shows that the writer was quite well aware of the way things were in the Persian Empire of that day. Historians can corroborate what's written here. And when I was in New York City, I went to the major post office building, which my wife Linda told me today that it's open. It's the only post office building in the nation that's open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And it's named in honor of Farley. And Farley was the Postmaster General, I believe, under Roosevelt. His name is very important in politics, particularly to those who are older and remember the name. He was very important in I believe New York politics. The building is named after him. But on the front of the building is an inscription which was written by the Greek historian Herodotus, writing in the 5th century BC about the Persian version of what we might call the Pony Express, the way the mail worked in Persia. You know, they wouldn't have had email. They wouldn't have had, you know, trains or buses or whatever, but they had runners and horses, and they were able to carry the mail. And there's a statement by Herodotus, neither rain nor snow nor however it goes, gloom of night can keep the postman from his appointed rounds. That's sort of what the statement is. And probably a lot of you have heard it. It's supposed to be the inspirational statement about, you know, what the mail carrier, you know, the mail must go through. I remember a song from Disney, "The Mail Must Go Through," right? And that's the way, Herodotus described the runners in the Persian mail system. The mail must go through, the mail must go through, no matter if it rains or pours. Because somebody has noticed, doesn't know the song. All right, but anyway, that wasn't Herodotus, that was Disney. But anyway, the Persian runners would carry the mail through the empire. So now the message gets out. Now, as I said, now the Jews have access to weapons, and now they have access to the authority, to the police forces of the day, and so on. And so now their enemies are the ones that are in big trouble. And so we have a complete reversal of fortunes. And this is comforting, you know, that things like this happen in history, so God gives us comfort and encouragement to know that ultimately his people will be the winners. You know, we're in exile now. Even if we're in a free country and a rich country, we're still spiritually speaking in exile until Christ returns. You know, and then we will have a very different world and a much better world. And of course, many people today are living in very, very dire circumstances. They're not necessarily in a country like the United States. There are people living in what we used to call the third world, who even right now are just barely surviving. Many, many people in the world. And many people are living in nations where their freedoms are extremely limited, to say the least. So anyway, we're looking forward to Christ's return and to the victory of the truth, and these encouraging interventions in history prepare us for that. You know, they encourage us along the way. So in Esther 9, now in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and that's the month we're in now, on the 13th day, you know, see, that's a lucky day. If you want to, not that there are lucky days and unlucky days, there aren't. But 13 is, in a sense, a good number for God's people. It's an unlucky number for bigots, racists, and genocidists, yeah? Jihadists. It's an unlucky number for them. You know, now if you want to look at it that way. Now, in the 12th month, in the month of Adar, on the 13th day, the time came for the king's command and his decree to be executed on the day that the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them. The opposite occurred in that the Jews themselves overpowered those who hated them. And if you continue reading the account, Esther is now queen, but much more active than she seemed to have been at first. Now that she's interacted with the king in this way, it seems that their relationship has been solidified and she's able to really exercise her authority as queen. And Mordecai has become second in command to King Ahasuerus, or Xerxes the First, you know, and so he's able to exercise authority. So they establish among the Jews all around the world to keep the festival of Purim. And in verse 29, you see that they, if you read chapter 9, they send out a document about it. And in verse 29, then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm the second letter about Purim, this second letter about Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, with words of peace and truth. Now, by the way, there's a couple of times in this book, I think more than twice, where it's mentioned that King Ahasuerus ruled over 127 provinces. Why is that hit so hard in the book? First of all, to show he ruled a vast empire, but also a person who's knowledgeable would think 127. That's how many years Sarah lived. She lived to be 127. And I think what we're doing is linking Esther with Sarah. Sarah was the great matriarch of the church, Abraham and Sarah. And as I said, there are four mothers, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. And so it links back with Sarah when you think of that 127 figure. You know, and so, as I said, you have that link. But you also are linked to Rachel, as I've said. Mordecai was a descendant of Rachel, and he adopted Esther. So anyway, verse 31, to confirm these days of Purim at their appointed time, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had prescribed for them, and as they had decreed for themselves and their descendants concerning matters of their fasting and lamenting. So they had been in great mourning. They were facing extermination. Now they were in great joy. Now for at least a certain brief period of time, you know, it was the in thing to be Jewish instead of the negative thing. Verse 32. So the decree of Esther confirmed these matters of Purim, and it was written in the book. So you see, here's a woman who, because of her position as queen of the empire, she has an important position where she's even involved in the writing up of an official decree, which establishes a festival that Jews keep to this very day. So you see the importance of Esther in the history of the church. So just in summarizing, you know, we see Rachel as one of the matriarchs of the church, and poetically she's there mourning for what happened in the region where she died. And yet at the same time, the prophecy is you will be comforted. And from time to time, we see comfort coming to Rachel. We see her descendants, the daughters of Zelophehad, you know, asking a fair question, getting an answer, so that, you know, women can inherit land as part of the nation of Israel. We see Esther and her heroism. And we see God intervening and turning things around at the time of Mordecai and Esther, foreshadowing what will yet happen in the future. And so we see Esther in that sense, or we see Rachel rather in that sense, through Esther being comforted. And of course, the great comfort will yet come. The great comfort will yet come. And that I'd like to talk about in conclusion in 2 Corinthians 6. There is coming a time when Christ will return. There is coming a time when Israel will be restored to greatness after first repenting and coming to a right relationship with God. And there will come a time when those children murdered by Herod will be resurrected and have their opportunity to come to a right relationship with God. And there will come a time when the church collectively, as the bride, will marry Christ, the groom, and children will be born from that union. as the billions in the world become church members and become part of the family of God. And so in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 18, we see this prophecy. I will be a father to you, 2 Corinthians 6:18. I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and daughters, says the Lord Almighty. We shall be sons and daughters of God forever, following in the footsteps of Rachel, of the daughters of Zelophehad, of Esther, and of the great heroes of the Bible. And we, as the bride of Christ, will then consummate the union, bring forth children, and each of us, in fact, will become sons and daughters of God forever. Well, again, I really appreciate those of you who came last week and listened. And even while I was speaking last week, there were people listening electronically. The family back here was hearing it, and then others heard it later, of course. And right now, I thank all of you who are listening to it and those of you who will be listening later on. So enjoy the rest of the Sabbath. And remember, it's only a month before the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. So we've got physical and spiritual preparations to think about. And several are coming here for those days. And we're grateful. We're looking forward to seeing them at that time. So in the meantime, all the best to you and your